This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. Thanks for joining us. It's time for Trumpet Hour Week in Review. We have our panel of writers ready to discuss the important events of this past week. Here in the studio, we have Jeremiah Jacques.
Good to be here.
And Andrew Miller.
Good to be here.
From our office in Britain, Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And from our office in Jerusalem, Brent Nachtigall.
Greetings.
This coming Sunday, the Trumpet will be hosting British journalist Melanie Phillips for a public lecture at our offices here in Edmond, Oklahoma. You can catch the live stream of the event online. Just visit thetrumpet.com for details. She's going to be focusing her lecture on the Arab-Israel impasse. This is an age-old subject that has been given fresh life in recent months and in recent days for a number of reasons. We're going to start today's week in review by catching you up to speed with these developments so we can all be well informed going into this weekend. For this, we're going to turn to our man in Jerusalem, Brent.
So it looks like we finally have some type of policy regarding the Middle East, the peace process that is emerging from the Trump administration. Just looking back to events this past week and also in the past month, over the past month and a half, we've had a lot of Arab leaders, leaders from Jordan, Saudi Arabia, some of the Gulf states, Egypt, all visit the United States. Iran, obviously, the minister who didn't have a meeting there at the table with the White House. But we've had that. And then just this past week, we've had Mahmoud Abbas, the leader of the Palestinian Authority, show up and meet with Mr. Trump as well. And it seems that these issues or these meetings are in many ways very connected. And they are a number of analysts are talking about how Mr. Trump is trying to link the support that he gives to the Arab states and the Saudis in particular, with them really trying to help motivate and mediate and pressure the Palestinians towards some type of deal with the Israelis. And while he didn't probably say as much to Mr. Abbas when he was there in the White House, this is something he has brought up with Mr. Netanyahu before, the hope that a regional peace deal, a regional closening of alliance with America, as well as Israel, with some of these Arab states, is going to lead to a peace breakthrough in Israel.
So it does seem like he's made some pretty strong pronouncements, President Trump, saying, you know, I think a deal is definitely doable. But what does he have? You're talking about him trying to broker some kind of agreement among these Arab states to pressure the Palestinians. Does he have any real leverage or anything new to bring to the table that would warrant this kind of optimism?
I think that, well, he's got himself, which of course that's he believes that he is the ultimate deal maker. So that's a big plus that we didn't have in the past 30 years. But what does he have on the Arabs to pressure them to do this? That's a very good question. I would say that he has Iran. He has the issue of Iran that all the Saudi Arabia in particular, Bahrain, Qatar, they're all worried about Iran marching across the Middle East. Everyone can see it. And I'd believe Mr. Trump has set himself up as being very anti-Iranian, at least the leadership there right now. So he can hold that as a carrot out towards the Gulf states and say, if I want your support, I will give you support in the fight against Iran. I've proven that I'm willing to have some military actions against them, like what I did in Syria against Iranian interests. They will continue, and I can hold back Iran's march across the Middle East if you help us out here, bringing the Palestinians to the negotiating table along with the Israelis.
It doesn't seem like there's anything in here that suggests any recognition of just how intractable the Palestinian position is, that there is still this basic refusal by the Palestinians to recognize Israel. That hasn't even come up. I mean, what President Trump said was, I believe that the Israelis want peace. I believe that the Palestinians want it. But he doesn't have anything to prove that, does he?
No, he doesn't. And even this meeting at the White House on Wednesday really did show that Mr. Abbas didn't show any signs of compromise. He mentioned that they still want Jerusalem as a capital. They mentioned they still want to have this division, the two states. Mr. Trump didn't mention two states, but Abbas did. And then he also mentioned the right of return as well. The idea that all the refugees that fled Israel in 1948 are somehow going to come back to the territory along with all the millions of children and then grandchildren of those refugees, which is basically a no-starter from Israel. That can't happen in any type of peace deal, or Israel is going to be swamped by this an Arab state on its border that's just massive. So even he still mentioned that right of return, which shows that he's not willing to give an inch. And yet, Mr. Trump seems optimistic. I mean, this is the same man, in fact, that refused a peace deal with great terms back in 2000, refused a peace deal back in 2008 under Mr. Ehud Olmert, and then refused to negotiate with Barack Obama of a similar peace deal. So three times he's had basically what Mr. Trump's going to offer him, three times, and three times he's already knocked it back. So again, I don't know, maybe Mr. Trump's got something that we're just not aware of that he can hold over the Palestinians. But from what we can see, he doesn't have a magic wand in this that's going to take away this impasse that's existed for 40 years.
All right. Other issues that are impacting the Israel situation right now.
Yeah, well, the other question is, do we have a partner for peace? Do we have somebody we can talk to? The PLO, or the Palestinian Authority, headed by the PLO, or Fatah, Yasser Arafat's party, has been the figurehead of the Palestinians for 30 years, I guess it is now, almost 30 years. And they have been the ones that have negotiated peace, or tried to negotiate peace. They've been the other party. But you've still got half the Palestinians that aren't being represented at the negotiating table. We're talking about the group Hamas, which basically controls half the Palestinian people. And it's like they are saying that the PLO doesn't speak for us. So even if you work out a peace deal with Abbas, what about the rest of the Palestinians? What about the Gaza Strip that isn't going to abide by it? So you're going to have some type of accommodation between Hamas and Fatah to even go forward at all. It looks like Hamas is trying to bridge that gap at least a little bit, and they've done so by releasing finally this week their new charter, which does away with a lot of the anti-Semitic terms that they had in their original charter in 1988. This one of Hamas, basically, it says that they'll agree to a Palestinian state, but that is only a temporary goal. The complete goal for them is from the river to the sea, from the Jordan River all the way over to the Mediterranean. That's their goal. They'll be willing to negotiate. The charter still says that. I'm going to quote from the new charter right now for you. I've got it here. It says this: Hamas believes that no part of the land of Palestine shall be compromised or conceded, irrespective of the causes, the circumstances, and the pressures, and no matter how long the occupation lasts. Hamas rejects any alternative to the full and complete liberation of Palestine from the river to the sea. However, without compromising its rejection of the Zionist entity and without relinquishing any Palestinian rights, Hamas considers the establishment of a fully sovereign and independent Palestinian state with Jerusalem as its capital along the lines of the June 4th, 1967 borders. So it's saying, we'll accept that temporarily, but that's not the end goal. We want everything. We want Israel gone.
The Trump administration is talking about making this peace deal. He hosts Mahmoud Abbas in Washington, and any peep about Hamas, it's almost like this is proceeding. I mean, I guess the question remains whether Mahmoud Abbas will actually put his signature on a paper or not. And yet, there's this whole other entity within the Palestinians that it's like it's being overlooked.
Right, and if they're not brought on board with the process, you will have a disaster of a crisis in the peace negotiations. The fact that Hamas isn't a part of it, or the people that Hamas is over, that the Gaza Strip wouldn't be a part of it, it's the big elephant in the room that nobody wants to talk about. That is the sign that it's going to be impossible to reach this peace deal, unless you see some absolutely dramatic changes from Hamas, which they might change their terminology, the way they talk about things, but they're still, as you just read, dedicated to the eradication of the state of Israel.
And very briefly, also the President Trump's movements in the coming months.
Yeah, so on the end of May, he's going to have his first visit outside the United States, foreign visit as the president, and his first stop is going to be Saudi Arabia. Basically, I believe, a sign of this, of his policy on Israel and also the Arab states, going to Saudi Arabia, not going to Iran, trying to show where his support lies. Perhaps he'll ask them to pay for a little bit more of their defense. But he's going there first, and then straight after that, he heads to Israel. And then after that, interestingly, he is going to the Vatican. So some have said he's trying to show himself as a man of all faiths, visiting where the two holiest sites of Islam are in Saudi Arabia, then Judaism's holiest site, and then the Vatican. I don't know about that, but I think he is trying to still work this. I think this deal, or this trip, is all about the Middle East, what he can do, contain Iran, try and get the Arabs on support for this push for peace.
Very interesting. Keep us up to date, Brent, and we appreciate you bringing all of that to us. This past week, German Chancellor Angela Merkel visited Saudi Arabia in advance of President Trump's visit there. She pledged to build up the Saudi military and the defense industry. Now, Trumpet readers and listeners know we're keenly interested in the German-Saudi relationship because of what biblical prophecy tells us about it, and the role that that's going to play in events just ahead of us. To learn more about this, we'll go to our man in Britain, Richard Palmer.
Yes, she's made some interesting moves here because Germany has a lot of strategic interest with Saudi Arabia. It wants to build up Saudi Arabia. You know, Saudi Arabia is one of the biggest opponents to Iran in the Middle East. However, it is politically very difficult for it to do so at home. The SDP, Angela Merkel's current coalition partners, for example, one of their kind of key things that they've kind of tried to insist on the government doing is cutting back its weapons sales to Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia doesn't have the greatest human rights record in the world, despite just being voted to the some kind of women's rights body in the United Nations. It doesn't have a great reputation there. So politically, it's been very difficult to... all of these 200 billion, you know, Germany sells 200 tanks to Saudi Arabia. That's not popular with voters. So it looks like what Angela Merkel strove to do on this visit was come up with a way to keep supporting Saudi Arabia militarily in a way that caused fewer problems back home. Mm-hmm. And so what they want to try and do is, instead of, say, selling arms to Saudi Arabia, build up Saudi Arabia's own industry and own military, but still using German companies. So one of the big things that came out of this, for example, is that the German army is going to train Saudi Arabian military personnel within Germany. And actually, that's a big step up in the cooperation and in the relationship. But they're kind of marketing it as we're stepping back from selling Saudi Arabia arms. And that's kind of under that cover, and that's the spin they're putting on it. They're slipping in some of this much closer cooperation.
Yeah, that's quite a remarkable development. You think about Saudi soldiers going to Germany receiving training up there. I guess they're packaging it in just the right way in order to sell it to the German public.
Yeah, I think the project's called Vision 2030 is the name of the project, and the idea is there'll be that, and then at the same time they're going to help Saudi Arabia build up their own arms industry, so they'll be independent of German weapons. And to a certain extent, they've done some of this already. One of the most controversial projects was Germany helped Saudi Arabia build a Heckler & Koch assault weapons plant quite a few years ago. And some of those assault weapons, their H&K assault weapons have found their ways into questionable places across the Middle East. And that factory is the probable source there. But then also, as we have an article on this subject on the website by Josué Michel, drawing attention to this. And he also talks about how they've been using the kind of convoluted means as well to trade with Germany. So, for example, Rheinmetall Denel Ammunition has been building a factory which is 51% owned by the Dusseldorf-based group Rheinmetall. And so, again, but it's actually a South African manufacturing company, despite being majority owned by the German company. So there's kind of been some of these bounce arounds to reduce the focus that's been there on this German, on the German links to Saudi Arabia.
So put this in context for us. We've talked, obviously, we're very interested in closely monitoring Germany's military moves. And we were just talking about how President Trump is building this relationship with Saudi Arabia as leverage against Iran and demonstrating that it is opposed to Iran's spread throughout the Middle East. It seems Germany is taking a somewhat similar course here.
Absolutely. I mean, we were just even talking today in international relations class about how strong historically Persia's been when it controls what's now Iraq, when it controls the Mesopotamian region, and how it, you know, that just really adds a lot of economic heft. And that when it's controlled that, traditionally it's been able to be the dominant power in the Middle East, projecting power all across the Middle East. And so you see Iran rising like that. Saudi Arabia is pretty much desperate for patrons. I think Jeremiah has an, if I remember correctly, has an article coming up in the next Trumpet talking about how Saudi Arabia is kind of reaching out. Well, he's focusing on the China angle, but they're reaching out to anyone that they can reach out to get some support against the rising power of Iran. And Europe is concerned about the rising power of Iran as well. And so there's a very natural alliance there between Europe and Saudi Arabia. Now, we have Bible prophecy pointing to the same alliance. And it's one of those kind of scriptures that comes up again and again in these Trumpet Hour programs. Psalm 83 talks about Europe allying with a group of nations, including Saudi Arabia, including the Arabs. And that's what you see building right now.
And you would tend to think, too, that Iran would really see any sort of military collusion. If they're seeing Saudi soldiers shipping out to Germany and training up there, that they would view that as a direct threat to themselves. And they're recognizing Germany is taking sides here and would be more inclined to want to lash out against Germany. Before we move on, Richard, you mentioned you were struck by some provocative comments from Germany's interior minister this week.
Yes, well, what I think is most interesting here, again, is the trend. But Germany's interior, well, last week, Germany's parliament passed a bill paving the way to outlaw full burqas, you know, Islamic face veils on public officials. And then on Sunday, the German interior minister published an article basically talking about how Germany needs a light culture. It's one of these words that doesn't translate well, but a kind of a guiding culture or dominant culture, and that this will help. Rather than multiculturalism, there needs to be this kind of guiding dominant culture for Muslims to, or anybody coming into Germany, to integrate with, and certain sets of principles that should be universal. But what I think is interesting is immigration is already a big topic in Germany. Islam, already a big topic in Germany. This has sparked a whole host of discussions, and some of his comments were quite controversial on this. You know, telling Germans to take a pride in their culture is not something that happens at all often within Germany. And so now you're seeing German culture, pride in German culture, become perhaps the central issue or one of the central issues in the German election that is still quite a few months away. And so this, I think, is something we're seeing it from the AfD. Before now, you're now seeing the Christian Social Union and now the Christian Democratic Union talking a lot about German culture, German identity, being proud to be German, German patriotism, taking on a really central role in the German election. And so it's going to be very interesting to see where that takes Germany's discussion of this issue over the next few months.
It's worth just pointing listeners back to thetrumpet.com. We have this new feature that we've been running for a couple of weeks now. This week in Germany, a video just highlighting some of the most interesting and alarming headlines out of Germany. we hope that you can continue to produce that video each week, and definitely something to keep our eyes on. We appreciate that. Richard, you're listening to Trumpet Hour, our week in review program on 101.3 KPCG. We've been following high tensions on the Korean Peninsula in recent weeks. There have been some high-profile weapons tests from North Korea, a contentious election campaign in South Korea, some verbal sparring with the Trump administration in the United States, and all this as the U.S. has been trying to install a controversial anti-missile system in South Korea that has a lot of the neighbors on edge. Well, on Tuesday, Washington announced the missile shield is operational. To learn about how this news is going down in Asia, we'll go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, this is called the Terminal High Altitude Area Defense, or THAAD, missile system. And as you said, as of Tuesday, it is now operational there in South Korea. The United States paid for this really advanced billion-dollar system under an agreement that was worked out between the Obama administration and the South Korean government years ago. And its purpose is basically just to be able to shoot down short and medium-range missiles fired from North Korea by the regime of Kim Jong-un. The purpose is to shoot those missiles down just to protect the American military forces stationed in South Korea and in Japan, and also to protect Japan and South Korea themselves, since they're staunch U.S. allies from, you know, any sort of potential North Korean attack. So that all sounds pretty good, protecting people against destruction by a lunatic military power. But not everyone was happy about THAAD being brought online. China is furious about this deployment. For one thing, even though China's patience with Kim Jong-un is wearing pretty thin lately, China and North Korea still remain allies. So Beijing doesn't like THAAD for that reason. But the even bigger reason is because China fears that the THAAD's advanced radar system will allow the Americans to sort of peer across the Yellow Sea there that separates South Korea from China and be able to take a look at Chinese airspace and even any sort of motions that are happening on the ground in China with their hardware being moved around. So ever since the THAAD deal was first announced, China has repeatedly denounced it as a violation of Chinese security and as just kind of a bullying move by the imperialist United States and all of those kinds of things. This week, China even came out and threatened to take some kind of unspecified measures to safeguard their interests. And then Russia is also unhappy with the THAAD deployment. Russia is not an ally to North Korea on the same level that China is. But Russia is still on the short list of countries that keep on doing business with the North, which basically keeps the Kim regime alive. And Russia also shares a small slice of border with North Korea, so they have close interests there. And of course, Russia just hates anything that they perceive as a show of force by America or any sort of muscle flexing by the U.S. The Russian foreign minister said, he spoke out about THAAD last April, and he said America, quote, shouldn't use Pyongyang's acts as a pretext to increase its military presence on the Korean Peninsula, end quote. So China and Russia are both very uneasy about the THAAD deployment. And actually, in South Korea, there's also some pretty serious opposition to it. President Trump very curiously came out a few days ago and said, despite the earlier details of the deal that were worked out, he said South Korea would have to pay for THAAD. And this infuriated a lot of South Koreans, especially those that already have some anti-American leanings.
Well, which is kind of the direction that the presidential campaign has taken in that country.
He seems to always ask for, he's asked on several occasions for others to pay for things that America wants. And you're right, in South Korea, there's already been a growing anti-American movement. The U.S. did end up backing away from that, and they said, yes, we will pay for this billion-dollar system after all. But in some ways, the damage was already done.
Right.
South Korea is in the middle of a highly charged presidential campaign right now, as you mentioned, and that statement by Mr. Trump really gave a huge boost to one of the leading candidates, a man named Moon Jae-in, who's quite a bit more anti-American and quite a bit more accommodating toward North Korea than other candidates. And Moon has even said that if he wins, he would consider dismantling the THAAD system. So many onlookers were, you know, just pretty puzzled by President Trump's statement there, and it seems like that won't do much to boost the stability of the region.
Yeah, well, it is interesting to see how the Trump administration's relations with these Asian nations are being put in peril, or they're being threatened over this North Korea issue and the THAAD system. And you could see China making that point. If you just imagine some other country saying, well, we need to guard ourselves against Cuba or whatever the case might be, and so we're going to install this missile system very close to America's shores, that would be an issue that would cause Americans some concern. And yet, just watching the tensions increase and watching these countries, the way that they're dealing with the United States in the Trump era, we just have to keep our eyes on the situation to see how it unfolds. But you can definitely see it getting more complicated very quickly. We appreciate that, Jeremiah. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. A new Pew Research Center report says there are more rich American households than ever. Trouble is, there are also more lower-income households, which means America's middle class is shrinking. The share of adults living in middle-income household was 61% in 1971. Now it's about 50%. Why this changing economic picture? To answer this question, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Right. Well, probably anyone who's listened to a speech recently by Senator Bernie Sanders was well aware that the American middle class is shrinking. He tends to not focus so much on that 6% of middle class Americans who've now joined the upper class, and more on the 4% that have gone and joined the lower class. But when you really dig into the statistics, what you'll find is the reason for this this change, this increase in income inequality, actually has quite a bit more to do with changing family structures in America than it has to do with the government not redistributing enough income, as has become more popular to say these days. And you notice that if you go back to 1970 and before, when roughly two-thirds of Americans were in the middle class, you really saw a situation to where if a household had enough money to live off one income, then usually the wife would stay at home and raise the children. And if a household didn't have enough income to be in the middle class, then the wife would go out and she'd either work part-time or full-time or whatever the case would be to get enough money that two-thirds of the nation was pretty solidly in that middle-class bracket. In the 46 years since then, though, you've seen two things that have happened. One is the family breakdown has gone to a point where between the divorce rate or people who just never marry and a number of other factors, you've gotten to where the percentage of marriage households has fallen from 71% of the nation to below 50. And on the other hand, you do see something where even families that could be middle-class families off one income still choose to have the both husband and wife work. And it's really kind of led to this divide where you've got like these rich, educated couples where both husband and wife make good income and have actually gone out of the middle class into the upper class because you've got twice the income you would have been typical a half a century ago. And on the other hand, between like family breakdown and divorces, you'll get a situation where the household income is declining, not so much because individuals are making less than they used to. They're just their incomes divided over more houses. Mm-hmm. If you have a husband working full time and maybe a wife working part time and together they're in the middle class, if they divorce, now that combined earning potential is divided into two households, which means that one or both are likely to be put down into a lower income bracket.
Well, we appreciate you putting those numbers in perspective, and it definitely does show the changing landscape of the American family. And putting it in economic terms does provide some interesting perspective to us. We appreciate that. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, we're going to talk about an agreement signed this week aimed at ending Syria's six-year civil war, a surprise announcement from the Roman Catholic Pope and the Coptic Pope, the Association of Southeast Asian Nations caving into China, and the fact that the world's best-selling book isn't being read much. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
It's been about a month since the United States launched a missile strike in Syria, but the situation there has remained pretty much unchanged. The war continues on. This week, however, an agreement was signed aimed at winding down that war, which has dragged on for 6 years and counting. Who signed the agreement and just what was agreed to? These are extremely interesting questions. We're going to let our Middle East analyst answer them, Brent Noctegal.
Yeah, so we've talked about the players involved in Syria being, the major players being foreign nations, Turkey, Russia, Iran. Turkey, of course, supports the rebels, those fighting against Assad. And then you've got Russia and Iran on Assad's side. And just this past week, we had all three of those, apart from the United States, although they had an observer there, those three nations came together and signed an agreement that they were going to set up the much-awaited safe zones inside Syria. This is areas inside Syria where any type of flyover is banned, where medical supplies and emergency supplies can get in really easily, something that the United States, underneath Mr. Trump, has called for in the north of Syria, a safe zone so that people have areas to go where they won't be barrel bombed by the Assad regime. So what we have is an agreement that is going to be put in place in, I think it's a few weeks' time, but once it gets some other little details worked out. But instead of just having one safe zone in northern Syria, we're going to have four separate safe zones throughout Syria. And the location of these safe zones shows you kind of, I believe, that Syria is being divided up into areas of influence by these major players. There is going to be a safe zone in northern Syria, like we expected, and that's mainly for the rebels to cling on to control of that area. That's the one that Turkey wanted. But there will also be three other safe zones that are on the western coast of Syria, down through kind of the center, down to Damascus. And they are the areas that Iran has been mostly concerned about. So it seems that while we have guarantors of these this agreement, one of them being Iran, which has been known to disintegrate agreements or destroy agreements after they're made, they are getting something out of this. The rebels aren't just finding there's somewhere safe for them to go. The Iranian-backed forces are also finding some safe places for they can go without the threat of being hit.
It's kind of an odd situation here, isn't it? For Russia and Iran and Turkey to be deciding here is the future for Syria and sort of carving the nation up into these strongholds where these warring factions could kind of hole up and bunker down. It's kind of strange.
Yeah, it is strange. And people have thought since the very beginning, maybe Syria needs to be divided along ethnic lines and maybe with areas of influence such as these. So that might be something that we're seeing the beginning stages of with these safe zones. I think it is interesting also just to think about who's losing in this agreement. And I believe the loser is Iran, just because at the beginning of the Syrian civil war, they were not willing to budge any territory to be given over or any safe zones for even to last year. No safe zones in northern Syria for the rebels to fight against, to retreat to. And the very fact that they've got some safe zones might be a saving face kind of issue in the southern part of the country. But the rebels aren't going to be there anyway. They don't have any aircraft to fight against them. This is really, what we're seeing here is Turkey pushing its weight around. And I think even Russia maybe coming on side with Turkey a little bit to ensure that Assad and the Iranians can't barrel bomb any longer hospitals of the rebels or anywhere that the rebels are retreating. And this is going to see them stay a strong factor in Syria going forward.
Thanks for that, Brent. While these nations are seeking a path to peace in Syria, over in Asia, it appears nations are looking for a way to come to some kind of accommodation with China. This Asian giant has been taking quite an aggressive stance in gaining control of the South China Sea by militarizing some islands there. There's been a lot of controversy about this, neighboring nations protesting and so on. It looked like this week, perhaps that tension dialing down a bit, these countries beginning to come to terms with what China is doing. To learn about this, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, or ASEAN, met this week. ASEAN is a group of 10 Southeast Asian countries, and it excludes China. Actually, for the last many years, one of the big purposes of this association has been to provide kind of a framework for the less powerful countries in the region to challenge China on certain issues and to present kind of a unified opposition to Beijing's expansionistic behavior, especially regarding the South China Sea. That's an area that most of these countries have territory in, and they pretty much all have fishing industries dependent on operations in the South China Sea. And other sorts of economic activity that happens there. And of course, China claims that entire vast area. So it's a big concern for all of them. And usually it's a major issue of discussion and even action for these ASEAN nations. But in this last ASEAN meeting, the members really surprised a lot of analysts by leaving China's South China Sea activities off of the agenda. All of China's island building and illegal militarization of those islands, none of that was on the agenda. So China was overjoyed. And actually, it looks like the reason why China's expansionistic activity in the South China Sea was basically left off of the agenda is because China pressured these countries to basically shut up about it. A Reuters reporter asked the Chinese foreign ministry spokesman if China had exerted pressure on the ASEAN nations. And the spokesman kind of dodged the question the way people in those kinds of positions normally do. But he did mention behind-the-scenes efforts that China had made. He said, quote, "Since last year, with the joint efforts of China and ASEAN countries, including the Philippines, temperatures in the South China Sea situation have gone down and things have eased up. I think this accords with the interests of countries in the region," end quote. So on the surface, that sounds good. Temperatures have gone down and things have eased up. But what really seems to be happening here is that these smaller nations have caved to China. They're fearful of what might happen to them economically or otherwise if they anger the Chinese leadership. So now the Philippines under President Duterte and these other nations seem to be just walking softly and trying not to upset China. So it to me, it just shows how powerful China is becoming and how fearful its neighbors are of it.
How much of a role did the Philippines play in this and President Duterte?
It seems like his actions were the ones that really set the scene for the others. The Philippines has the most to lose from allowing China to basically colonize this vast area, the Spratly Islands, for example, and a lot of other territory there is clearly within the Philippines' exclusive economic zone. And so the fact that President Duterte backed off and decided not to make this an agenda item, I believe really set the stage for the other countries that stood to lose less from caving to China.
So China continues its march. We appreciate that, Jeremiah. As we mentioned on last Friday's show, Pope Francis visited Egypt last weekend. Well, he wasn't the only major Christian leader there. While he was in Cairo, he met with Coptic Pope Tawadros II of Alexandria, and the two leaders issued a surprising joint declaration. For this, we'll go back to Britain and hear from Richard Palmer.
That's right. The two leaders agreed to recognize each other's baptisms as valid. And this is quite a big deal. One baptizes by sprinkling, one baptizes by immersion. But also this, I mean, the Coptic, the divide here It's one of the biggest divides in any between any two kind of modern Christian groups in a lot of ways. The Coptic Church split off from Catholic Orthodox Christianity, you know, 500 years before even the Orthodox schism. 451 was around the date of the split there, and it was the Copts are what's known as monophysite, and it's this. There was this around the time. There was just this incredibly intense fight about the nature of Christ, and it sounds incredibly picky to modern ears about whether Christ had one nature or two natures, and it gets very complicated very quickly. But a lot of blood was spilled over this. Emperor Justinian's reign, it threatened huge amounts of instability. Bad blood between the Copts and other monophysite groups and Orthodox Catholic Christianity is one of the major reasons why Egypt is Muslim now rather than Christian. They felt like they were being downtrodden by the Orthodox Christians and therefore were more ready to side with the Muslims when they invaded. So this is a huge split within Christianity, and now they're recognizing each other's baptisms. They've taken some very significant and major steps towards unity.
Why is the trumpet interested in this story?
There's very specific prophecies about Christian groups having unity, about the Catholic Church gathering in those other churches that have split out from it. And Isaiah 47 talks specifically about this. Mr. Armstrong drew attention to this. He talked about Protestant groups being brought back in, about Orthodox groups being brought back in. I don't think it didn't specifically go quite as far back as the Coptic split, but it certainly seems like that would be included in the Catholic Church gathering back in these Christian churches. But it's interesting because this story as well, it's kind of at where two different trends that we're watching connects as well. Because you look at why they had this unity, and there was, of course, that attack that we've talked about on this program a few weeks ago, where Islamic State terrorists came very close to killing the Coptic Pope. They tried to attack the church that he was preaching in, detonated outside. And so you see this kind of clash of civilizations that we've also talked about, and this growing clash between Islam and Christianity, and that kind of forcing Christians to close ranks. And these Christian groups to close ranks. And we've seen talk along those lines. It was 2013, I think it was, that the Pope talked about an ecumenicism of blood, of these unity from blood. He said in some countries they kill Christians because they wear a cross or have a Bible. And before killing them, they don't ask if they're Anglicans, Lutherans, Catholic, or Orthodox. The blood is mixed. For those who kill, we're all Christians. But you're seeing very concrete effects of that now, where, you know, there's no discrimination in this persecution, and so Christians are discriminating less or putting fewer differences between each other in this face of this outside threat.
Yeah. Well, very, very good story. We actually have the article up on the website, and it's by the man we'll be hearing next from, Andrew Miller, Catholics and Copts Recognize Shared Baptism, looking at it in terms of the unification of these churches and also just the way that these Christian churches are uniting together in the face of an Islamist threat is quite interesting to watch. We appreciate that, Richard. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. This is our Week in Review on 101.3 KPCG. One final story that we'll talk about before we move on to our lightning round. A Christian organization based in Nashville, Tennessee, published a survey this week saying that nearly 9 out of 10 Americans own a Bible. That's great for those of us who appreciate the Bible. Only trouble is half of them have read little or none of it. To learn more about this, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Right. Well, that is just kind of a really interesting study, just showing like the religious landscape of the United States, because it's also the same. Like roughly 9 out of 10 Americans own a Bible, as you mentioned. It's also roughly 9 out of 10 Americans believe in a God, which is, I think, the highest percentage of any Western first world nation as far as belief in God. But yet they had mentioned before that like less than half of them are actually reading it. I think even more specifically, they this survey brought up an interesting statistic that only 39% of those who attend some sort of worship service monthly read the Bible daily. And there's obviously there's a bit more than that 39%, I'm sure, who are reading the Bible on like a weekly basis or that. But as far as just like searching the scriptures daily, as there is actually a scripture that tells you to do, it's only just over a third. And one of the interesting statistics this survey brought out is that there's actually more, I guess, Christians voted for Donald Trump as president than actually read the Bible every day. They said, again, of those Christians who attend a religious service monthly, roughly 45% voted for Donald Trump in the past presidential election, even though 6% less than that are actually reading the scriptures daily. So it just does kind of put this perspective. You're hearing a lot about like the evangelical religious revival in America today after the 8 years of the Obama administration and some of the more draconian restrictions he'd put on like military chaplains, saying that you can be fired if you quote scriptures in a counseling session against homosexual marriage or against premarital sex. Or you hear these stories about Christian bakers who are being sued by the state governments for refusing to bake a wedding cake for a homosexual wedding, and the Obamacare fiasco where they had like the Little Sisters of the Poor or these other Catholic religious organizations who are steadfastly religiously against any form of contraception being forced by the government to pay for abortions and other forms of contraceptions for their employees. And so you do hear a lot about the religious revival in America now that you've got a different president. But it does kind of put in their perspective that a lot of this is like a political backlash against the previous administration. But it, unlike what historians would call the first American Great Awakening or the second Great American Great Awakening, this isn't really a revival in people's interest in the scriptures. Because mm-hmm. As I said, like Bible, people who are reading the Bible daily is at lower than it's been in decades. Even though that you do have a number of Christians who are very excited about a new president who may change some of the past political restrictions they've had on Christian organizations in the United States.
Yeah, if you're interested in learning more about this story, go to thetrumpet.com. We've got a couple of stories up there. One, more Christians voted for Trump than read the Bible. It's got the breakdown of the statistics that were revealed in this Lifeway survey. There's also an article about this, about Donald Trump passing a law restricting the IRS's ability to remove tax-exempt status from religious groups for being a little more open about their political views. That kind of ties into the same story. Thank you for that, Andrew. Again, this is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. Visit thetrumpet.com to read this and many other stories that we talked about on the program today. We have up on the website if you're interested in more information. We're going to finish the program with our lightning round of important news. That's coming up next.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
It's time now for our lightning round. We'll take one last look at some headlines that caught our attention this week, and we'll start with Richard.
There's a far-right scandal emerging in the German military. They found one man who was looks like he was a neo-Nazi. He looked like he was planning an attack and then planning to make it look like it was carried out by a Muslim immigrant. But it's gone much further now, with the German defense minister saying that there's a much wider problem, saying that the authorities turned a blind eye and that the German military has an attitude problem.
All right, over to Brent.
This past Tuesday was Israel's Independence Day, and to celebrate, UNESCO passed a resolution demanding that Israel disavow Jerusalem as its capital. The measure passed 22 to 10 with 23 abstentions, but judging by the smell of cooked meat pervading the city on Independence Day, as well as the fireworks that were keeping me up the night before, there are plenty of people in Jerusalem that would have something to say about this resolution. Nevertheless, there were some people in Israel that actually took the vote as a positive, considering less nations voted for the measure than the last time there was such a ridiculous UNESCO vote. As a result of the vote, Israel decided to remove the last $1 million of its funding for the UNESCO organization.
And to Andrew.
Communist, socialist, anarchist, and anti-capitalist of all types celebrated International Workers' Day on Monday. In communist countries like China, North Korea, Cuba, and Vietnam, the day was marked by massive Soviet-style parades, as they do every year on May 1st. In the capitalist world, it was celebrated in its typical way with demonstrations and riots. The protests turned violent in several cities, as anarchists and other protesters forced police to cancel permits and arrested dozens of protesters. Police in Paris, London, New York, and Washington were on high alert throughout the day, especially after rallies in Seattle, Washington were marred by clashes between pro-Trump and anti-Trump protesters. And protests in Portland, Oregon were marred with Molotov cocktails being thrown at police offices.
And over to Richard again.
German Chancellor Angela Merkel traveled to Russia to meet with Vladimir Putin this week. It's the first time the two leaders have met since 2015. It was not necessarily described as the friendliest meeting, but the trumpet, we watched that relationship closely, and it's significant that they're talking to each other again.
Okay, and now to Jeremiah.
North Korea says the CIA in the United States devised a scheme to assassinate Supreme Leader Kim Jong-un. They say that a certain North Korean was supposed to use some sort of biological substance to kill him. The plot was foiled, apparently, and it's hard to know if there's really anything to these accusations, but this sort of thing will just add to the already difficult tensions on the Korean Peninsula.
Okay, and back to Brent.
More evidence came to light this week that proves Iran and North Korea are working together on some of the most dangerous weapons. On May 2nd, Iran attempted to launch a cruise missile from a midget submarine in the Strait of Hormuz. While the launch failed, it's still important because Iran and North Korea are the only two countries in the world that operate these midget submarines, which can hide and travel in shallow waters. According to intelligence reports, Iran's sub was, quote, based on a Pyongyang design, the same type that sank a South Korean warship back in 2010. Our listeners can look forward to an article by Richard on this subject that should appear on the website shortly.
And over to Richard again.
Britain is looking at selling off its flagship of the Royal Navy at bargain basement prices. But more than that, HMS Ocean is also Britain's only amphibious warfare ship, you know, used for launching amphibious landings. And if it goes, then Britain wouldn't be able to retake the Falklands, for example. It would be a major blow to the capacity of the Royal Navy.
And Andrew.
Prince Philip announced this week that he will be retiring from royal duties at the end of the summer. The prince is both the Duke of Edinburgh and the husband of British Queen Elizabeth II. He has endured a grueling schedule at the monarch's side for the better part of a century. Now, a month ahead of his 96th birthday, he's announced his upcoming retirement.
All right, and over to Jeremiah.
The president of the Philippines, President Rodrigo Duterte, has been invited to the White House by U.S. President Donald Trump. This invitation has really infuriated a lot of defenders of human rights, since Mr. Duterte is accused of abetting death squads and carrying out thousands of extrajudicial killings as part of his signature war on drugs. But it looks like President Trump is more concerned with maintaining America's alliance with the Philippines and with keeping the Philippines from rushing into China's arms than he is with standing up to those human rights abuses. And from an international relations standpoint, Mr. Trump's invitation seems to make sense.
And back to Richard for our final one.
British teachers have been receiving some novel advice of late. For example, one teachers' union on April 11th told British schools where they have a transgender student enter the class, they should bake them a cake and make it a positive experience. They're being warned to expect a huge surge of transgendered or non-binary students, and they're being told to adjust their education and, you know, basically promote this to take that into account.
All right. I'm Joel Hilliker. We're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Visit thetrumpet.com to read the stories that we talked about on the program today, including the one about cakes for transgenders. If you want to contact us, you can email letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal.
Thanks for having me.
Great to be here.
Thanks to our staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with the words of Joseph de Maistre. False opinions are like false money, struck first of all by guilty men and thereafter circulated by honest people who perpetuate the crime without knowing what they are doing. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.